Hi, this is Josh Fonger, and welcome to the Work the System podcast, where we help business owners move from owning a job to owning a business, mastering their systems so they can simplify growth. And today, I have a special guest, Mike Michalowicz. Mike is the author of Profit First, Surge the Pumpkin Plan, and his newest release, Clockwork. By his 34th birthday, Mike had founded and sold two companies, one to private equity and another to a Fortune 500. Today, he's running his third multi-million dollar venture, Profit First Professionals. Mike is a former small business columnist for the Wall Street Journal and the former business makeover specialist at MSNBC. Over the years, Mike has traveled the globe speaking with thousands of entrepreneurs and is here today to share the best of what he has learned. Okay, so Mike, how did you get into this line of work to eradicate entrepreneurial poverty?
Well, I had to start off with my own poverty. There was a time I thought I knew everything about entrepreneurship. I've been an entrepreneur for the entirety of my adult life and made a lot of money early on and assumed I was like God's gift to entrepreneurship, that I was Midas. Anything I touched turned to gold. And I'm not. Apparently, I'm actually an idiot because my third company was a total disaster as an angel investor. Actually, I call it the angel of death because I was so bad. I was like collapsing company after company. I lost all my money and realized at that point, Josh, that I thought profit was an event, that if I grew a company fast enough and sold it, because I'd done that a couple times, that's when you make your money. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I try to do with this angel investing company, and I destroyed myself. I realize that many entrepreneurs have that same perception, that one day we'll make money. But there's something more insidious going on. The outside world thinks that we're wildly successful. Like the day you open your business, all your friends who don't own a business are like, oh my God, you are worth millions and you sit on the beach drinking Mai Tais, you do nothing. The reality is we are impoverished. We have no money. We made more money in high school as a waiter or waitress, and we're working our butts off. It's relentless. So there's this gap between the outside world's perception and the reality, and it is stressful and devastating. My life's purpose is to close that gap of entrepreneurial poverty and make what is perceived the reality for all entrepreneurs.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. When I travel to consulting clients out, I'll do a little scenario with a dollar bill and show employees what profit actually looks like after you tear up a dollar bill. And they all think that the owner's pocketing 50 to 60% of revenue. They have no idea that the owner's pocketing like 1% of revenue.
Yeah, a lucky owner. Yeah. You know, yeah, a lot of them are actually having to put in another buck just to keep the business going.
Yeah, no.
There was a statistic I read, and I don't know what the exact number is, but they say like after 5 years, 50% of small businesses go out of business. And my argument is those are the lucky people, the ones who went out of business, because the ones who survive, it is mouth to mouth, or mouth to mouth, yeah, it's check to check, hand to mouth, that's probably better, hand to mouth, check to check survival. It is this constant stress. And I'll tell you, closing a business is better than that constant stress, but the best solution, of course, is achieving sustainable profit. And that's what I think we all need. And we can do it.
Yeah, we'll make it happen. Well, I'm excited to get into some of your content, some of your books. And there's really, I mean, we talked a little bit beforehand. There's so much to cover, so many great books. So certainly those of you who have not heard of Mike, you need to go to his website. You need to check out his books. There's a lot of great stuff there. Just because of time, let's start with your newest book and the one that I think is going to fit our audience the best, because we're all about building systems, building businesses that run themselves and work for us. And that would be Clockwork, Design Your Business to Run Itself. So let's start with that book. Why'd you write it and what's the premise?
Well, I believe there's a hierarchy of needs we go through. Actually, I'm working on a new book that translates Maslow's hierarchy of needs to an entrepreneurial hierarchy of needs. And I think every business needs to have sales as a base. You know, without sales, a business doesn't exist. We need inbound cash flow. I think the next level up is profitability. We need to be retaining cash to sustain the business, but also to sustain ourselves as an owner. And the next level up is order or systems, where a business can run on automatic, because that allows the entrepreneur to no longer carry the business on their back, but to extract them. Mm-hmm. And sadly, you know, thank God for Work the System. There's not many books out there that talk specifically about systems. That is the foundational book, Sam's book. I wanted to write something that was a complement to it. And I hope more books come out about this concept of how do we make the business run in the absence of the owner? Because the healthiest business is not dependent on the owner.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. It's a single point of failure. Hard to make it happen, though. So, what are the steps? So, in your book, you lay out kind of the steps to actually go from being in there, you know, in the business as entrepreneur, or as Michael Gerber would say, to working on the business. Yes. How does that happen?
So I outlined seven significant stages through this, but I think there's really three that we need to nail down. The first one is categorizing how the business is operating now within the scope of what I call the 4D mix, D as in David. And I believe any business is experiencing these D elements. So here's what they are. And by the way, as I outline them, every business must be doing all these elements at all times, but the entrepreneur must scale themselves up to the highest D. Mm-hmm. The first D is called doing. So every business is doing an activity that derives benefit to the customer. So that activity is a doing activity. Also, anything that supports the infrastructure and allows the business to derive that benefit to the customer is doing activities. So like if I'm a lawyer doing legal contracts and going to the courtroom, that's doing work. If I am writing invoices to my clients or marketing, that's also doing because that supports the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of any business, we follow the Pareto principle, 80% of every business needs to be focused on doing. And as a solopreneur, you got to be the doer, right? You got to be running the business, but you got to be the chief bottle washer too. The next level up is called deciding. And deciding is where we start bringing on external resources. We hire that first virtual assistant or maybe a part-time or full-time employee. What happens here is we task rabbit them. We say, go do this task, do invoicing, and they come back to us for decisions. That's what the deciding phase is all about. For me, for example, I hired this one gal, her name was Jackie. As I was growing my own solopreneur business into a larger entity, I gave her the task of doing invoicing. She left the room, came back a minute later and says, how do we sort taxes, invoices? Is it by last name or first name? I had to make a decision. I'm like, well, we've always done it by last name, so let's continue. Mm-hmm. She came back in, do we bill in 15-minute increments? You know, lots of questions. And initially, this stage is like, oh, wow, she's a learner. She wants to grow. But when these questions continue on incessantly for weeks and then months, she's an idiot. I'm like, can she not figure this out? Like, oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. So the employee that's better than sliced bread becomes stale bread very quickly. Mm-hmm. That's the trap of the deciding phase. There is a Hindu goddess named Kali. Kali is a single female head with eight arms. And that's where our business becomes. One brain, the owners, making decisions for the entire organization, which inherently is a limiter. We can't do work ourselves because we're constantly answering questions. Mm-hmm. So we need to elevate to the next level up, which is delegation. Sadly, most entrepreneurs say they're delegating work when they're actually deciding about work. They're task rabbiting. Delegation is not the assignment of work. It's the assignment of outcomes. Instead of saying, hey, Jackie, please invoice, I say, Jackie, it's important that we bill clients in a timely and accurate fashion. Do you agree with that? And why? And she would say, well, because then we're fair to our clients, because it's accurate, we're fair to ourselves, because we're doing it promptly, so cash flow is supported. I say, exactly. I want you to achieve that outcome. And we have a best practice internally. We have an invoicing process. Here's the key. When I gave her the invoicing process now, I say, any questions, any decisions you have to make, it's your responsibility. And she would come into my office, and I think many entrepreneurs know this, you have to reflect the decision-making back upon them. So when she came in with that question, it's easy as an employee to ask questions. Actually, it's very smart because now you can do no wrong. If I give her bad input and it's a bad outcome, it's not her fault. She followed instructions. It's my fault. Plus, it feeds my ego. So from my vantage point, putting out another fire, answering another question, I feel like a superhero. Mm-hmm. So I need to deflect back the decisions to her. But there's one more stage that very few entrepreneurs know about and very few do, yet this is the most critical stage. And this is why so many businesses fail to delegate, go back to that deciding phase, and they limit their growth. Delegation, true delegation, is not just the assignment of outcomes. It is also the support for all decision-making, even when Jackie or your employees make bad decisions. True story. Jackie was doing invoicing. She came back to me one day and said, Mike, we have a growing client base. We have a lot of people with the same first name, last name. It's getting confusing. We need a better way to sort out the invoices. She said, I made a decision. I'm like, this is awesome. What'd you decide? She's like, we're going to sort our clients by middle initial. And I bit my tongue like super hard. I put on kind of like a joker smile. And I'm like, good. Okay. Jackie, the fact you did something that you believe will move us forward to billing timely and accurately is awesome. Go do it. She did it. No surprise. It was a disaster. But she came back about a week later and said, Mike, it's actually worse this way. I said, really? She said, I've decided something new. I'm going to sort by a coding mechanism. I'm going to use their initials plus a number sequence. I'm like, great, go do it. That now is our standard. Mm-hmm. If I didn't support all of Jackie's decisions, she would start to question herself and her responsibility. We would, as a company, revert back to deciding. So delegation is the approval and rah-rahing, the support of all decisions. It's a coaching mechanism, but you need to empower your employees to make decisions, which then frees you up to the final stage. The final D is called designing. And designing is where we have clarity on the outcome we want for our organization. Then we choreograph and organize all of our resources to achieve that outcome. That's tactical and strategic decisions made sometimes on a daily basis to move us there. It is making sure that everyone's in alignment. For example, I can come out to my 14 colleagues here, or 12, it's actually 12 here and two remotely, but say everyone was here. I could come out to them and say, you know what? New goal for our business this year. We're going to do $10 million in revenue. We got this. How bad do we want this? And everyone may fake cheering, but inside they're like, oh, I care about 10 million because it's my business. I'm the one who gets the nice new shiny car if we do it. Mm-hmm. Amy doesn't care about 10 million. She cares about flexibility in her job. She wants to be able to go home when her husband comes back from a trip, impromptu. You know, other people have their own goals. So a designer has clear outcomes for the organization, but also clear goals for every individual within the organization and aligns the motivation of their own personal achievement with the goals for the business. And now we have perfect alignment. We as entrepreneurs, in summary, want to move from doing work to designing outcomes. Yet we need to keep this balance. Someone has to be doing. So we want to be giving that to employees and colleagues and other people to be doing while we continue to throttle up to the designing phase.
That's very interesting. Now, with the percentages, the first one you had 80%. Are there percentages for the other ones in terms of where you should spend your time, depending on your business size?
Yeah. So what we found is it's 80 for the doing stage, about 2% for deciding. So deciding is relatively avoided, but at times when you bring on new colleagues and stuff, you need to give them initial direction by making decisions for them. Mm-hmm. 8% of time or so is spent through delegation. This is where a management team comes in, empowering decision-making, being really mentors to their team, and then 10% is designing for an organization overall. But if you look at a large organization like, say, Amazon, I suspect Jeff Bezos, I never interviewed him, but I strongly suspect he's spending upwards of 90% of his time in designing. And the rest of his team is probably helping with what's the vision, the future, how do we choreograph and organize our resources to achieve that vision? But I'd also argue Jeff Bezos sometimes does sales. I mean, he's not running to the warehouse and packaging up your Amazon Echo order, but what he is doing is when Amazon is considering a new headquarters they're going to establish, he's on the front line doing the negotiations, the sale for that. So I think we'll always have a mix. We just need to continue to throttle ourselves up as the leaders of the organization toward designing, but ensure the business has a balance throughout.
I think this is a great mix. And I've seen this a number of times. And what I'd like to do is, and maybe you do the same, is when I look at what an owner actually does, they'll tell me exactly what they do. And then I'll go to the top and say, well, it looks like no one's the owner of this company then because no one's doing the designing.
It's true.
You know, no one's doing actually finding the new locations, the new vendors, the new branding, the new partnerships, that like the new things that CEOs have to do, the innovations, their R&D, the risk taking. If no one's doing that, then you're just kind of in the doing, maybe deciding a little bit, but then you're just stuck.
That's about it. Yeah. The vast majority of businesses in the US are 3 employees or less because we're stuck in the deciding or doing phase. We're the best technician, as Michael Gerber would say, for the work, and we are deciding for the other people, task rabbiting. The funny thing is, Josh, the day before we start our business, that's usually the last day of designing. That's where we have this grand vision. We can smell and sense what the business is going to be like. We have such clarity over it. There's so much excitement. But the very first day we open the doors, we're like, holy crap, I have no money coming in. We dive into doing, and then we never leave that spot for the entirety of the business. We need to start bringing back the balance. The one challenge, I actually met with Michael and we were discussing this. He's an eccentric guy, fun guy. He's unique. Uh-huh. We keynoted together in Mexico. We went out to dinner afterwards. Well, me, him, and his bodyguard went out. And I was telling him, I love the concept of the E-Myth. The one challenge I have is that many readers, myself included, saw that as a switch. Like, I have to work in the business long enough to free me up to work on the business one day, thinking it'll be a switch. And my argument was, it's actually a throttle. And that's what his intention was. I think just many people read it as a switch. And in Clockwork, I hope to give people a pathway to slowly but persistently throttle up to the design phase.
No, that's perfect. And those of you who are familiar with the book, Work the System, who've been following our podcast, same thing with our audiences. They think, oh, now that I've read this book, I'm just going to do everything systems. Just flip a switch. It's all systems. Right, someone else will do it. And I'm like, well, someone still has to do the work, you still need to grow before you can delegate. And so that's great. All right. So in the book, I was reading through the book Clockwork recently, as we talked about, and there's this whole idea of the QBR. Yeah. And so can you explain a little bit about that and the importance of that for entrepreneurs?
Well, good. This was the second kind of key element to the three major components. The QBR stands for the Queen Bee role. And I think if there's one takeaway I hope people take from the book, it is this concept. I went, as I was writing the book, and studied dozens of businesses that had achieved extreme efficiency in their industry. So I remember going to a company in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. It was a manufacturer of play sets, $75 million in business, extremely efficient. It's called Playworld Systems. I met with pizza shops and all these different places that were like the best of the best. And I was looking for the common thread in efficiency. And while they had all achieved it, they all had their own script. I couldn't find the core essence of it. So what I did was I reverted to looking at nature. And I believe that nature is the ultimate master of so many things that we just need to observe nature and translate that back to business. That's where I discovered the process that bees follow. Bees are extraordinarily efficient. You may notice one day a bee flying around your window, and the next day there's this massive hive there. Question is, how do they scale so quickly? They follow a simple two-rule set. Rule number one, every bee knows that the most critical function of the beehive is the production of eggs, because the survivability of bees are very limited. The longest a bee will live, depending on the species, is 6 months. Some of them only last 4 weeks. You know, there's a lot of turnover, if you will, in beehives. So every bee knows egg production matters the most. The happens that in beehives, the queen bee, there's a single bee, produces eggs. So every bee is making sure that eggs are being produced. Now, the problem is some people start liking this to their business and say, well, what's the egg production for our business? What's the most critical function? And they think it's one person doing it, the queen bee person. That's where this analogy falls off, because it should be protected. Maybe multiple people should serve it. In fact, in beehives, even though one queen is producing at any time, there is these other bees that are queued up, ready to take over immediately by a spawning sequence to replace the queen bee. So if the queen bee is failing to produce, sorry, but she's removed from the hive. And they spawn a new queen bee and egg production goes. It's that critical function. The second rule is, once the bees know the critical function is being served, more eggs are being produced, they go and do their primary job, which may be collecting nectar or defending the hive or something. For our businesses, every business has a singular, most important doing activity. We need to know what it is. We need to define it, and then we need to serve it. It needs to be humming along, and nothing else matters unless that's happening, because that is that's the most important part of the business. As an analogy and to find it, I like to use the example of FedEx, because it's such a global brand. Everyone recognizes FedEx. FedEx has a big promise. And for us as business owners, we need to determine what is our biggest number one promise we make to our customers. FedEx promises to deliver packages on time. Me, I'm an author. My promise is to make entrepreneurial tools that are very simple and usable. That's my biggest promise. Then we peel back the onion and say, of all the activities we do, what's the one most important activity to deliver on that promise? And so for FedEx, it's logistics. Yes, they have customer service. Yes, they have other services they provide, even printing services if you go to one of their local shops. But their biggest promise is the delivery of packages on time. That's their egg production. If they fail to do that, they're done. Like if FedEx says, you know, let's start next week. Who cares about the packages? Let's just be super friendly on the phones. When packages arrive, that's fine. What will happen to FedEx? The news will break. FedEx doesn't care about package delivery. Your package won't get there on time, and their business will tank almost overnight. Conversely, if FedEx says, screw customer service, you know what? Let's not even answer the phones, but we're going to deliver packages on time. What will happen to FedEx? FedEx will continue to hum along. Yeah, maybe they'll be compromised a little bit because they're not friendly, but they're delivering packages on time. That's why we hire them. We have to determine for our business, what is the biggest commitment we're making to our customer? I know we make multiple, but what's the one biggest one? Then ask ourselves, what's the number one doing activity that makes that a reality? That's your QBR. Every employee, bee, needs to be defending and protecting it. It needs to be humming along. If it is compromised, it needs to be addressed immediately. And FedEx, as a final thought, does this every single year. Their biggest promise, delivering packages on time, their QBR, logistics, gets threatened every year around the Christmas holidays. So the winter holidays come about, package demand soars, it puts strain on their logistics. What do? They take the managers out from behind the desks and say, drive those trucks, start delivering packages yourself. They hire part-time work to work at the distribution center to ensure that packages are moving quickly. They will never compromise that QBR, and we can't either.
I think I love this idea of the big promise. And so for entrepreneurs listening to this, I run into this all the time where they are scattered. They have so many different things they're working on, and they kind of give them equal importance.
Yeah.
Is there a technique or a way people can figure out their biggest promise?
Yeah. So ask your customers. And shockingly, very few of us do. And here's the king of shocking. Like, I never asked my customers. I just assumed, oh, my customers want this and that. So ask your customers, why do you buy from me? What's the biggest thing you're getting from me? What's the biggest benefit you're deriving? That is your big promise. Now, here's the thing. Once you figure out what your big promise is, what customers really buy from you, there's other things you do too. You still have to be in the ballpark in those. Like for me, writing books that make entrepreneurial tools that are very usable is the big promise. But the books better be engaging and edutainment to some degree too, to keep readers on there. But I'll tell you, if I just make like this yuckity yucka Umbozo the clown book and there's no value in it, I'm done. Mm-hmm. But I still have to be in the ballpark in the other areas. So define what your big promise is and then build or stay in the ballpark in the other elements. But your customers know that big promise.
Hmm. No, that's great. That's going to really help me out with some of my current clients I'm working with. So what's the next thing? So you have your 4D mix, you kind of figure that out, you declare your QBR. At first I thought that was a quarterly business review. So you get the QBR, and then what's next?
There are a few other steps, but they don't play nearly as much significance as this final step. So I'm going to throttle this right to the end.
Okay.
At the conclusion of the book and the conclusion of the clockwork process, I mandate, I guess is the right word, or request that the reader, the people implementing the system, schedule a 4-week vacation. And when I make this absurd request, people are like, you're smoking cocaine or something. Like, there's something really wrong with you, Mike. Because think about it. What I'm saying is you have to remove yourself from the business for 4 consecutive weeks, a full physical and digital disconnect. This is not a workcation. It's a permanent removal. And I'm not focused on the vacation. You go on that famed trip to Rome or stay home. I don't care. Mm-hmm. What I do care about is that your business can run independently of you. Because if a business can run 4 consecutive weeks, for most businesses, that's considered a full cycle. Invoicing happens, new clients come on board, you may have to hire or fire someone. All elements of the business are touched, for most businesses, in 4-week cycles. So what we do, even though this is the final step, it's the first call to action for readers, is schedule a 4-week vacation a year and a half out from now. Not tomorrow, but a year and a half out from now. What this does is it forces a mental shift. The next morning you come in, you're like, holy cow, I can't carry this business on my back anymore because I'm heading out. And if I leave for 4 weeks and the business depends fully on me, we're out of business. So it starts shifting your mentality from the doing mentality to a designing mentality. Now in the process, we schedule a 4-week vacation, but as we start approaching it, we take these mini breaks, removing ourselves from the business for maybe a week, then coming back, seeing what didn't work. If you leave for a week, even if disaster strikes, most clients will accept that and wait for you. So you come back and see what didn't work. Those things that didn't work are the things that need to be systematized and repaired. Then you go, you repeat and over, and you get to 4 weeks. The final point, by the way, about this is an American phenomena. When I tell American entrepreneurs, you got to take a 4-week vacation, they gasp and they're like, I could never do this. I'm like, you have to. It's interestingly, when I present this in Europe, people are like, well, this is how we live already. Most Europeans take August off. And BMW hasn't gone out of business. So it is definitely a proven model. It works. And it brings around not just life balance, but it brings a business that can run on its own independently of you. And when you can run a business without any of your active input, that is the most valuable business. It's truly turnkey.
Mm-hmm. That's very, I was going to ask you about the international thing. Same kind of thing. People in Europe already do that. So they wouldn't think, well, that's not a big deal.
Yeah, they're like, isn't that how business should be? Yes. The Europeans figured it out first.
People in the U.S. are very obsessive about their work. So there's obviously a lot to go with in terms of going from working in there 24/7 to having 4 weeks off. What have you found is the most useful in terms of owners getting things out of their head and putting systems into place? Like what are the techniques that you've seen work?
Yeah, so we call it a capture. And actually, this is one of the steps in the book is capturing systems. I think the traditional approach has been SOPs, mm-hmm. Write down the steps, spend a significant amount of time to really get clarity on this, deliver to another person, say, here's the script to do things. I challenge the value of SOPs now. I think there's a new standard or better, more efficient approach because technology is advancing so quickly. Plus, reader attention is disappearing. So it's a confluence of two horrible events. So true story, I wrote an SOP. I gave it to Jackie. It was about shipping books. Mm-hmm. And I said, Jackie, here's the new process. It took me about 16 cumulative hours to write this. I went to the UPS website, took pictures. It was a beautiful document, showed how the packages are made, and said, here's the process to follow. She came back to my office about 10 minutes after starting this new process and said, we have a problem. UPS changed this entire website. And I'm like, are you kidding me? And the entire SOP that took 16 hours was shredded right in front of me and thrown into the garbage. And that's when I realized that we need something different. I think the new standard, which is superior, is a capturing process. When we do something, there's only three forms of input nowadays. One is on computer. I type in, you know, invoicing or shipping. One is a verbal command. I'm telling someone, hey, do this, or I'm instructing someone in some fashion, they're responding. Or it's a movement. I'm taking a package, shifting it around. All three of those elements can be captured. The movements, you can use your smartphone and just videotape this and then give a tape recording of the action to someone else to duplicate. Same thing with voice. You can just record on your phone. Mm-hmm. On a computer, you can use some kind of screen capture software. We use Loom. We're not like, you know, sponsored or anything by them, but just found this thing, Loom, L-O-O-M. It's great. So we film it. Now what we do is I give the best practice to someone else and say, as I'm literally doing it, so I'm actually completing the work, recording it, and giving someone a recording to duplicate. That's how we capture systems. But there's one more element, which is actually the most critical. Again, sadly, the most infrequently done. The necessity for once the person receives that video and now is responsible to do it, they must subsequently record another video also training it, even if it's just for themselves. The reason is the best student in the room is always the teacher. If I give someone a process to follow, they are doing it out of rote, out of just copying. When they have to teach it, now it moves to a much more conscious level of process and decision making. So you have to make them record the process too.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's great. We're big on that, trying to get them engaged in actually defining how things are supposed to go.
Yes.
Sometimes you really do need to spoon feed it to them. And a lot of times, at least in my case, my team knows how to do it better than I do. So I just say, you write the process for this.
Yeah, right. And the best thing is now if that person decides to move on to other opportunities, they leave, but their knowledge doesn't.
Yep. Oh yeah, that's what we always say. Systems stay and people come and go, but the systems stay. Exactly. So you want to build that infrastructure. Well, very cool. Well, I want to jump into your other book, Profit First, just because so many of my clients are obsessed with it and they're certified. And I think, you know, with our limited time left, let's just dive right into it. So for those who aren't familiar with the book, Profit First, what is that about and how can that apply to our audience?
So we were talking earlier, Josh, about kind of this hierarchy of needs and the one base hierarchy is you need sales coming to an organization, then you need profit, some way of consistently taking out profit. And then the next level is systems, right? To organize all that stuff. The profit level, what I found is from my personal experience, I was growing businesses that weren't profitable. I'd started these companies, but I wasn't taking money out of them. I was actually becoming very resentful of my own businesses. I then heard a study that, and I don't know the source anymore, but it was that 83% of small businesses, that's a company that does $25 million in revenue or less, according to the SBA. 83% of small businesses in the US are surviving check by check. Global studies, 180 million small businesses, 83% are surviving check by check. And check by check means if we don't get enough money into the business today, there's not enough sales, we can't cover payroll or rent, let alone pay ourselves. What I believed originally with the problem was me. I thought there was a part of my brain missing. Like I could do all these other things, I could sell and prospect, but I couldn't figure out profit. I then came to realize the fundamental formula that we follow, I believe, is tragically flawed. We are told that sales minus expenses equals profit. Is written in thousands of accounting books. It is the foundation of accounting. In fact, every entrepreneur group I talk about calls profit the bottom line or the year end. I get it from a logical standpoint, but we don't get it from a behavioral standpoint because it's human nature. When something comes last, it means it's insignificant. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's the last on my list. Insignificant. Oh, my health, I'm gonna put my health last. Really? That means it's insignificant. When something comes first, we say, I'm gonna put my health first. Well, that's the first thing I'm gonna do. So what we need to do is flip the formula because if profit comes last, it's the perpetual manana syndrome. It's going to wait a few months or a year or maybe 20 years out from now. Instead, we're going to bake it into every transaction in the business. Sales minus profit equals expenses. What I mean by this is every time we have a sale, we're going to take a predetermined percentage of that money, whatever the percentage may be, 1, 2, 3, it'll grow 10, 20%, allocate it toward a profit account, hide it from the business, and run the business off the remainder. What we do here is we've always believed that profit is an event. If I just stick it out long enough, and what I teach in Profit First is that profit is not an event, it's a habit. We're going to bake it into every transaction of the business by taking our profit first. Mm-hmm.
And also within that book, I noticed you go through the detail, all the different accounts that you could or should set up. I thought that was great because I know most of my clients are just, they're managing their business by looking at their checking account, seeing how much money's coming in. So tell us about how to do that. What is the framework for actually deciding what accounts to have and why to have those accounts?
Sure. So what I want to point out is first is that is the natural behavior of most entrepreneurs is to do what's called bank balance accounting. Even though we're told, read the income statement, the balance sheet, the cash flow statement, blah, 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 blah. I don't read those. And frankly, I don't really know how to read a cash flow statement or a balance sheet whatsoever. So what do? I revert to bank balance accounting. I log into my phone, as I say, once a week, honestly, about once an hour. I log in my phone and I'm like, do I have money? And I follow a real simple system. If I have money, I'm like, oh, okay, I have money to spend and I buy equipment or do whatever. And if I have no money, which seems to be more frequent, I panic and I'm like, I don't know what to do. I set Profit First as a system that intercepts our natural behavioral path. And that's the key, that we don't need to change our habits. We continue to log into our bank accounts. But what happens is by setting up multiple accounts with multiple pre-intended purposes, we know what intended use that money has before we spend it. Mm-hmm. I call it 5 foundational accounts. I believe every business should have 5 foundational. Based upon the type of business you're in, I explain different accounts that you can set up. The 5 foundational are this. An income account, it's a serving tray of cash. Money comes in there. We never spend a penny from it. It just displays how much cash is coming into our business. Kind of like for dinner. You have a serving tray. You never eat off the serving tray. You give portions of food out from it. The next account is called profit. Profit is a reward for being a shareholder. The fact you started your business or invested in it, either through money or sweating into your business, you are an investor. You own stock and you've taken extraordinary risk. Hopefully it goes up. If that goes down, you're responsible for it. So profit is a reward for taking on extraordinary risk that 97% of the world population will never do because they're not entrepreneurs, but you are. That's the profit account, a reward for the shareholder. Next account, number 3, is called owner's compensation. This is to pay the salary for what's called the owner operator. If you work in your business still, and most small businesses require that, we're going to pay you a salary. And you're likely the best employee of the company. Not only are you an owner, you're also probably the best operator of the business. You can sell better than anyone. You know inherently better than anyone. You care for the business more than anyone. We're going to pay you accordingly. So that's your salary. Next account is called tax. We start our businesses for 2 reasons usually, because it gives us joy, and secondly, for financial freedom. Mm-hmm. Well, if you have to pay your taxes and you can't afford them, that's not financial freedom. Financial freedom is not having to worry about money. So the business is going to reserve our tax liabilities for us. And regardless if you have a sole proprietorship or an LLC, LLP, S-Corp, C-Corp, hybrid, whatever it is, your business can pay your taxes for you. You've got to work with an accountant. You may have to do what's called a reimbursement distribution, or you may do a direct tax allocation. That's a minor component. The business will pay your taxes. And the fifth account is called OPEX. This is what the business runs off of. What happens now is when you log into your bank account, we're taking money out of that income serving tray. We're carving it up based upon percentages to different accounts. When $1,000, for example, comes into your income account, you no longer think you have $1,000 to run your business because you never had. That $1,000 has multiple responsibilities, paying you, profit, tax responsibility, and a portion of it goes to OPEX. That portion is what you have to run the business off of. We're reverse engineering the profit.
And for those of you, I mean, there's a lot of great stuff there. If you need more help, obviously go to the book or get a Profit First professional.
Yeah, please.
But it's all great. I think what I love is the psychology aspect of it is just don't fight human nature. Realize that we're gonna work with what we have. And you mentioned the end there, you end up with the bottom line, which is operating expenses, and that's all you have to run your business on. So then you get what is the outcome when you only have that limited number to work with? I'm assuming innovation happens or new ideas happen.
Yeah, there's a lot of behavioral principles I talk about at a very surface level. It's not like this is a book on psychology, but there's a concept called Parkinson's Law. And Parkinson was a theorist from the 1950s studying human behavior. He said, as a resource expands in its availability, we consume more. This is true for many things like the use of time, food consumption. Plates have become bigger today. That's why actually I'd argue our waistlines are getting bigger because portions have become bigger. What he said is, when it comes to money, in regards to resources, as more money flows into our business, we consume more. And entrepreneurs see this all the time. You look at your income, it's going something like this. Expenses almost uncannily are following in the exact parallel. That's the implication of Parkinson's law. So what we're going to do is we're going to restrict some of that cash flow into the business and allocate to profit first. So it gives this artificial restriction for a good reason down. And now you're forced to have a lower spend. So there's forced frugality. But to your point, more importantly, Josh, there's innovation. We start saying, well, I have less money. How do I get the same or even better results with less money? Maybe we start buying used equipment instead of new equipment. Maybe we don't need to hire that employee. Maybe I'm just kind of playing a psychological ego game here. We start to look at things far more innovatively than ever before.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think so. That added pressure. Otherwise, you have a good month. You're like, oh, I have 100 grand in the bank.
I'm rich. I'm buying some stuff.
Instead of like, oh, wait, this is going to taxes. This is going to profit. Yeah. This is going up. Wait, actually, I need to make better choices. Well, that's great. It's a great book and it's a great concept, especially for those who are struggling being profitable and paying themselves and paying taxes, and they wonder why, even though their company is growing. It's great for that. Well, just a couple more questions before we sign off. With all of the books you have, knowing our audience is small business owners trying to put systems into place to grow their business. Is there a first book you'd say, start with this one and then work through, or where would you have them start?
There is, but I don't know what it is. That sounds kind of totally weird, but I used to say, oh, you've got to start off with the pumpkin plan or whatever. Here's what I discovered. I now ask entrepreneurs a question. So I ask back, well, what's the biggest challenge you currently face? You know, if it's systems, read Work the System or read Clockwork. Yeah. You know, if it's hiring, I haven't written the book. Maybe read Top Grading or something. If it's sales, then it's the pumpkin plan. If it's profit, then it's profit first. If you're a brand new startup, maybe it's the first book I wrote called The Toilet Paper Entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. But the thing I'm doing now is I'm asking people, think about your biggest challenge. Maybe I've written the book and maybe I haven't, but you will be best served by finding the book that addresses your biggest challenge, deep diving into those topics, reading all the books on that subject, coming to a common thread in your mind that works for you and applying that solution. Mm-hmm. I kind of copped out, but I don't have a best first book that's necessarily one I can recommend.
That's the same thing I say when people say, what's the best book to read? I say, well, either read this one, Working System, behind me. And if they haven't, you know, beyond that, I just say, you know, pick the challenge that you actually have.
Pick your challenge, yeah.
Otherwise, there's a million great books, but they all...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, great content out there. All right, so final question. What's one thing you want to leave the audience with? And where can people find you?
The one thing is, we'll go back to profit first because that's what we wrapped up on. Huh? I understand many people may have skepticism. I was actually skeptical too. It almost is too simple to work, I thought. I've been doing it for 10 years now. We have over 100,000 companies, 3,000 document case studies, 100,000 plus are doing it. So I'm confident it may work for you, but the only way to prove it is to test it out. So my final call to action is try it out, but start small. Like, you don't need to do the entire system. We just started to outline some of it. It gets even more involved. I would suggest go to your bank today, set up one account, call it Profit. So it's just checking your savings account and allocate 1% of your income. It's that simple. If you start doing this, you'll start proving to yourself that it can or maybe won't work for you. But as money comes in, allocate 1% to profit. Now you've taken profit first and you're permanently profitable. There's actually cash sitting there. And then as you roll along, maybe you increase that to 2 or 3%. And then you can see if the system works for you and then use the entire system. And then to find out more about me, my website's mikemichalowicz.com. Impossible to spell, long, Polish. So there's a shortcut. It's Mike Motorbike. That was my nickname in high school. The great irony is I've never driven a motorcycle ever. But if you go to mikemotorbike.com, it's easy to remember. You'll find me. All my books, chapter downloads are free. I'm a blogger. I'm a podcaster. I used to write for the Wall Street Journal. All of that content is available for free right now.
Great. Yeah. I would say that's probably the biggest challenge you probably faced in business was those people trying to find you.
Oh, spelling your name wrong. My name is Murderous. I learned from another book. They said, determine what your biggest weakness is. And I said, it's my name. And they said, make your biggest weakness your strength. And so what I did is when people do visit my website, there's a whole, like, you can't miss it. Like, there's ways to make fun of my name. And it's become this kind of anchor point of people just busting my name. And it's actually become now elevated. So it's a technique, I guess.
Oh yeah. I mean, those want to check out the website. I was there last night. I think I hit the button like 15 times.
Just and starts talking to you, right?
To hear the jokes.
Yeah. That's a great... And then there's some nasty words in there, but those are true things. Like, my friends used to call me, you know, the horrible names. So I'm like, okay, all my friends, the nicknames they had for me, we're going to have them all up there.
No, it's great. It's great. All right. Well, Mike, I really enjoyed this. This has been helpful. I hope those listening have learned a lot about how to be a good entrepreneur and not to eradicate poverty in their lives.
Eradicate entrepreneurial poverty. Yep.
All right. And then thanks everybody for tuning into the podcast today. I look forward to sharing another podcast with you next week, helping you build systems in your business so you can work less and make more. Thanks, everybody.